From NPR News, this is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Then, 10 years ago, a nation stunned but unified in both grief and resolve, a firefighter called Mike was off duty that morning, took his kids to school in New York City, then raced to Engine 33 to find his station house empty.
Of course, my engine company was gone. They had gone down there. I saw them pass on Chambers Street while I was at the school. I saw them going down to the fire. As of last night, we got one guy back. So, I'm hoping they were right. I don't know.
One important change over this decade. Earlier this year, U.S. Special Forces shot and killed terrorist commander Osama bin Laden. Marine Sergeant Liam Dwyer heard the news while on patrol in Helmand province in Afghanistan.
Well, the word got passed over the radio, and you could tell the Marines were pretty ecstatic about it. I mean, we're, if you want to call it, holding back our emotions being out on patrol there, but you could tell, you know, everybody kind of got uplifted at that point there. I wanted to pass the word to the local populace, but I didn't want to come directly out and be like, oh, did you hear Osama bin Laden was killed? I didn't want to come across as crash and harsh like that.
Even now, some things have not changed much for Whale, a doctor in Kansas City, originally from Egypt, whose wife wears the hijab.
I got to tell you, it's you know, just to go out to dinner sometimes is very interesting because, you know, you get a lot of stares, you get a lot of looks, and some people are just flat out rude. And, you know, you just get a lot of unwanted attention, and I think that's increased more so.
9/11, then and now. Call and tell us what's changed. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Talk of the Nation commentator Ted Koppel is with us, and we want to focus this hour on three groups affected more than most these past 10 years, the U.S. military, Muslim Americans, and first responders. And we begin with the story of one first responder, a firefighter from New York. It's also the story of our colleague Michelle Martin, who hosts NPR's Tell Me More. Her brother, Norman McQueen, is the firefighter we're talking about. He was working for the New York City Fire Department on September 11th. And Michelle joins us from her home here in Washington, D.C., and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil. Hello, Ted.
Hello.
And can you tell us a little bit about your brother?
Well, he was very funny. Very strong. He was always interested in bodybuilding. He, we used to call him Conan well, forgive me, Neil, Conan.
That's all right.
To call him Conan the fireman because he was always very concerned about physical fitness. You remember, he's a second generation firefighter. Our father was a firefighter. He was second generation. My brother actually worked for the New York Fire Patrol. He was in Patrol House 2, which was a salvage corps, which was created in the 19th century by the New York Bureau of Fire Underwriters. And their specific job was to try to minimize the damage from firefighting, particularly to secure equipment, and which is, you know, part of the story actually later on. But he was very proud of his work. He was very proud of being a firefighter, as was my father before he retired. Took the job very seriously, studied hard. He actually had a degree in fire science. He went back to school in order to focus, you know, his studies on firefighting. And he was a very gentle person, a very nice person. And I don't know what else to tell you. So,
well, that day, it was all hands to everybody. More or less, was called down to the World Trade Center.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I was listening to that firefighter who had taken his children to school that day and then saw his unit go by. A similar story. My brother was assigned to Fire Patrol 2, but he was out of position that day. I think they were shorthanded at Fire Patrol 3, which is in Brooklyn. So he was actually at the 3 that day. And the 2 was heavily affected by 9/11. Keith Roma was one of the members of the fire patrol who was killed on 9/11, and we would, you know, my brother would wonder whether if he had been where, you know, he was where he was supposed to be. He was supposed to be at the 3, but if he'd been at the 2, mm-hmm. you know, what would have happened?
It's so. One of the eternal problems of survivor guilt. If you'd done something differently, if you'd been somewhere else, and.
Which he had in spades, I have to tell you. And I do often wonder how many people who are in the service, who are first responders, You know, the New York City Fire Department is the largest in the country, as you would imagine, given the density of New York, just as the police department there is the largest in the country. But my brother's unit was a small one. There were only 100 full-time members of that particular unit, and they all knew each other, as you would imagine. And I can't speak for anyone else. I can only speak for my brother. I do know that he had survivor's guilt in spades. It was, you know, should I have been there? I should have been with my guys. You know what? And I assume at some point you'll talk about why we're using the past tense here to talk about him.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask about, and yes, we will. But one of the things I wanted to ask about was, your father was also a firefighter, as you mentioned. Your brother, after 9/11, one of the things that emerged is that he didn't want to talk about it.
No, but I think you and Ted would attest to this. The more time you spend, you know, doing something difficult, the less you want it to become cocktail party conversation. And I think that for people who have faced, you know, real situations, serious situations, and have, well, it, you know, not to be melodramatic about it, who have put their hands on death, you don't want it just to be something to talk about. It's something, it's almost a way you can't really talk about it. And if you can talk about it, you talk about it with the people who really and truly understand what it is and what you've lived through and experienced. I remember when he was in the second wave that went down to Ground Zero. I remember for some reason, you know, he and I never crossed. I was always looking for him. I was down there myself, you know, working as a journalist in the days, you know, hours and days immediately after the attack. But I was always looking for him, and I never found him. We were always, you know, looking for each other. At one point, I talked to him. It was about 2 weeks later. He'd been down there 2 weeks straight, pretty much, you know, all day, every day, until they were ordered to go home and get some rest, which none of them wanted to do. But I remember that he did call me and say, and I said, well, what are you going to do now? He said, I'm going to go home and watch Animal Planet. And he said, and I hope I could take a shower before I fall asleep, but that's what I'm going to do.
And we are talking about your brother in the past tense, because that day cost him, and the subsequent days cost him a great deal.
You know, it did. And I think that, I've written about this. It's not something I talk about very often, obviously, but my brother took his own life last year in May of, in May. It was a shock, as one would imagine. But the truth of it is that there had been a prior attempt. He had, a couple of months after 9/11, he had jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge and survived, and in uniform, actually, on his way home from a shift. And through the incredible efforts of the New York City police, who, and an off-duty officer who saw him get out of his car, and I thought went to him, thought he was having car trouble, and went to give him a hand and saw him jump. And he then was able to give his coordinates to a boat, you know, patrolling in the area. And this was right around Thanksgiving of the same year. And so clearly there were signs that he was in distress. I think it's very clear that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress. I think, you know, in subsequent years, he fought hard. I mean, he did get help. He did get help. But who knows why anybody does anything, but I don't know that it was enough. And I don't know, frankly, that there's enough of a context for most people who do work like that, that is hard, that can be dangerous, that where their bravery is involved, where they see themselves as warriors. You know, they don't see themselves as warriors necessarily to act defensively as one would in the military, but they do see themselves as fighting a fight. They see themselves as, you know, fighting a fight against chaos or against fire or to save lives or to rescue people. And I think it's very hard for people, if those who are doing that work, I hope, don't mind my generalizing, I think it's very hard for them to admit that they're vulnerable, that they're hurting, and that they need help. And, you know, I don't know now I have, you know, survivor's guilt, wondering, what is there something I could have done or any of us could have done to help him more than we, of course, tried to do. But I don't know. I think it's always going to be hard. I mean, and to be honest with you, you know, the reason I'm making a point of mentioning that he was with the fire patrol, his particular unit closed in October of 2006. And I don't think he ever found work after that made him feel that he was doing something as important. So I question whether it was it 9/11 or was it the inability to kind of find work that seemed right, that felt meaningful enough to him after that. And so that's something that I often think about, and I think about a lot when I look at these unemployment numbers. And I look at and I wonder how many of the people who, all those people, you know, those are numbers. It's the we say those numbers like 9.1%, 9.6%. But behind every one of those numbers is a person. And I think a lot about who is that person and what is that person going through? Does that person feel worthless? Does that person feel that he or she doesn't matter anymore because he or she doesn't have a job, and not just a job, but a job that makes him or her feel as if he or she's doing something important?
Ted, I wonder if you had a question.
I just have an observation that sort of tacks on to what, and Michelle and I are very old friends, so we've talked about this before. We excel as a nation in commemorations, in anniversaries, in sending people off to war. One of the great tragedies is we do not excel in welcoming back the people who are damaged. And I don't mean welcoming people back with a parade. I mean dealing with the wounds of war, whether those be physical or emotional. And just as Michelle made the point that her brother was a firefighter, emphasis on fighter, these men and women are warriors who have to put their vulnerabilities on hold while they're at war. And when they come back, they need help. Many of them. Not all of them, but many of them do. And we don't do very well at helping them. And I think the 10th anniversary of 9/11 is certainly an appropriate time to recommit ourselves to the notion of trying to help those who are so badly hurt.
Ted, stay with us, if you will. Michelle Martin, thank you very much for sharing that story with us today. We're so sorry about the loss of your brother.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you, Ted.
Michelle Martin, host of NPR's Tell Me More. She joined us from her home in Washington, D.C. President Obama, last hour, laid a wreath at the Pentagon near where Flight 77 slammed into the building. The attacks on 9/11 dramatically changed the military. We'll talk about that next. Stay with us. This is special coverage from NPR News. This is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. Among the many events marking today's anniversary, Vice President Joe Biden spoke this morning outside the Pentagon. He was there to mark the moment, 9:37 a.m. Eastern Time, when an American Airlines 757 flew into the south side of the building. 184 people died, and the military almost immediately mobilized for action.
Never before in our history has America asked so much over such a sustained period of an all-volunteer force. So I can say without fear of contradiction or being accused of exaggeration, the 9/11 generation ranks among the greatest our nation has ever produced, and it was born right here on 9/11.
Vice President Biden speaking this morning outside the Pentagon. We'll talk with a member of that 9/11 generation in a few minutes. We're talking about 9/11 then and now. Call and tell us what's changed. In this segment, we'd like to hear from those of you who've served in the U.S. military over the past decade. Our phone number, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. No institution more changed by 9/11 than the U.S. military. Retired Army Major General Mike Davidson is former assistant to the chairman for the Joint Chiefs of Staff for the National Guard, and he joins us from studios of Louisville Public Media in Kentucky. And Mike, nice to talk with you again.
Hi, Neil. It's great to be back.
And as you look back over these past 10 years, the U.S. Army and the Marine Corps in particular have undergone enormous stress.
Very, very different Army and Marine Corps than we had on September 10th. We're a better Army. We're a battle-tested Army that comes at a very high cost, not just the casualties, but as Ted mentioned, the traumatic brain injury, the post-traumatic stress issues that we're dealing with and will deal with, the repeated deployments, the burden on families. This has been a tough time, but we've stepped up to the plate, I think.
This is an all-volunteer force. A tiny fraction of the American public has borne an awful lot of the stress since 9/11.
Less than 1%, significantly less than 1%. But that's a very elite force. I've mentioned to you before, 75% of the 18 to 22-year-olds in America are not eligible to serve in the Army for a variety of reasons. So we're recruiting just from the top 25% on any standard, and they have they've made me proud to be a soldier.
As you look at the kinds of changes that were imposed, and we're talking particularly about the ground forces, the Marines and the Army, because their tours have been more stressful, I think it's fair to say, than those in the Navy and the Air Force, for the most part.
They have. And if I can tie back into your first responder issue, there was an iconic photograph of three or four firefighters in the rubble that at the time was very appropriately compared to the raising the flag on Iwo Jima. And it brings to mind hearing Michelle's story that heroism and patriotism were lots of different kind of uniforms, but it's still the same heroism.
Captain D.J. Skelton was at West Point when the attacks happened. He found himself on a battlefield in Fallujah in Iraq not long afterwards and was severely injured there. He took an RPG to the chest, and Captain Skelton joins us now from Bavaria in Germany. Good to have you with us today.
No, it's my pleasure to be on the show.
And you're known to some as America's most wounded soldier. Boy, there's a distinction you'd rather not have.
Well, you know, I'd hate to say that the title has been branded, but you know, as you know, there are many severely wounded, aside from myself, that have had the honor to be able, really in this generation, to stay on and continue to serve and continue to do what we choose to love to do.
Some people will be surprised, perhaps, that after the tremendous injuries you suffered, you went back to Afghanistan 6 years later.
That is correct, sir. And I got to tell you, it wasn't my original intent when I was sitting in the hospital bed to wake up and to get back to the line. I think it was a series of events and progress over that 6 years. But I tell you what was very unique was watching over the 6 years. When I got wounded, of course, set a timeline, that was before the Walter Reed story had hit the front page of the Washington Post. So I got to seeing a lot of changes within the Army and within the military of how we look at wounded warriors and what they can, what we can or cannot contribute to the fight. And I tell you what, it's been a joy to see in a very quick turnaround an organization and bureaucracy as large as the Department of Defense adapt to a new environment and actually create programs and adjust how we manage our personnel to allow someone like me with the injuries that I have to continue to serve, let alone command a infantry company in a tough fight in Afghanistan.
Ted?
I'm just so concerned, and either Mike or the captain can respond to this. I keep hearing about the extraordinary number of former veterans, particularly Afghanistan and Pakistan veterans, who are homeless, who are on the street, who are unemployed. You know, I don't want to get into a debate over whether we're doing enough for these men and women, and I know both of you have served beyond measure. But just address that point for a moment. Would you speak out for the men and women who are out there who are really hurting and who have not been helped?
I'll start on that, Ted.
We'll start with the general. He outranks you, Captain.
Okay. Oh, wonderful.
Well, I do by rank, but perhaps not by service. But let me start on that. Great question. It's incredible to me that in America we could have any homeless veterans, any. And I think the estimates range around 8,000 to 10,000. It's not for want of commitment. Rick Shinseki is one of the best soldiers I ever had the privilege of serving with, who is now Secretary of the Veterans Administration. He will move heaven and earth to address this problem. But the bureaucracy has not been agile and adept and focused on this issue. I think, frankly, private foundations, some of the, I won't go into the details, but some of the labor unions are looking at addressing this issue, particularly in California. So I want to say that help is on the way, but let's see how it goes.
Captain Skelton.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think there's two things here. One, I think over the last 5 to 6 years, through the overhaul, there's been just an enormous amount of programs and resources thrown at this, but I think it's come so quick that we just haven't had the opportunity to get that message filtered all the way down to the veteran at the service member at the time that they transition, so they leave the military just not knowing what's out there. Another contributor to this as well is, you know, there's a lot of employers out there that are reluctant to hire service members that have multiple combat tours, because I think there's this misperception that those of us that have multiple combat tours also bring to the employment some of the negative aspects, negative perils of war, such as post-traumatic stress, combat stress, emotional stress as well, which is not necessarily the case. But again, if we come back to education on both sides and making sure we can get the right resource at the right time to the right people, I think that'll drastically close that gap and help that unemployment and the homeless issue that's on the rise currently with our veterans.
Neil, can I just ask the general one more question? Because I was just blown away when you said a few minutes ago, General, that 75%, I think I heard you correctly, 75% of the young men, and I guess you mean men and women, between the ages of 18 and 22 would not qualify. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. It's a staggering statistic. I heard it from the three-star that was responsible. I went and checked it with another three-star. It's now gotten wider circulation. 75% of the 18 to 22-year-olds in America are not eligible to serve in the United States Army. That comes from three...
What does that mean?
It means we have too many kids that are obese, too many kids that don't graduate from high school or get a GED, too many kids that have a brush with the law. But what it really means is that our Army is more isolated now than I think it has been in my lifetime, so that you have a reservoir of patriotism and self-sacrifice in the Army that is not getting filtered out to the wider population, and will be a better Army if we can reach back into that other 75% and bring some of the other Americans into the military. And to his credit, our recently, former Chief of Staff George Casey has started some programs to get back into that other 75%, but it's a crushing problem.
I wondered, Captain Skelton, I know you must feel very proud of the men you serve with and in your infantry platoon, infantry company, forgive me, but as you look at that statistic, and do you feel that you're just a very exposed, tiny part of America, that you're being asked to do a lot of things, you and your men are being asked to do a lot of things that perhaps ought to be a greater, more shared sacrifice?
You know, I would have to agree that I think the U.S. military population and their families are carrying the vast majority of the burden of the conflicts that we're involved in, both not just in Afghanistan but in Iraq and many of the conflict zones across the world. But Yeah, and I have heard the statistic as well that I think less than 1% of the American population actually serves in uniform. But I tell you what, as much as we like to think that there's a growing disconnect and a growing gap between the service members, their families, and the citizens of America who we've volunteered to help protect, when you still travel around the United States, and here I am half a world away in Germany, I get a lot of recognition from those that know that I serve in the American military, in the American Army at a time of war, who offer to assist and who ask if there's anything that's going on, if there's any struggles that I'm going through, and if there's any way that they can help. So, again, I do think that we do carry the majority of the burden of what's going on, but I think America and the world recognizes that burden that we have as well as our families.
Captain Skelton, thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
DJ Skelton joined us from Bavaria in Germany. General Mike, good to talk to you.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Mike Davidson, former assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for the National Guard, also the author of Victory at Risk, Restoring America's Military Power, a new war plan for the Pentagon. He joined us from Louisville Public Media in Kentucky. Wanted to add this email from Susan. I was teaching my 7th grade language arts class, only instead of English, my students and I had all eyes on the television. I could see in the reaction of one student in particular a personal affront that New York, his former home, had been hit. Plus, I could see a burgeoning patriotism. This student, Reese Murphy, went on to graduate college last spring today. Ironically, he began the Crucible, the grueling 50-plus mile run that's the final step in Marine boot camp. Later this month, I will proudly travel to see him graduate boot camp, something that undoubtedly grew out of that terrible day 10 years ago today. Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf is the founder of the Cordoba Initiative, a multi-faith organization that works to encourage interfaith dialogue, and he joins us from his home in New York, and it's good to speak with you.
Thank you very much, Neil. It's great to be with you.
And what significance does this day have for you and for you in particular?
Well, for me in particular, it was incredibly traumatic. It changed my life because I have been imam of a mosque in Lower Manhattan, just a dozen blocks from the World Trade Center, for over a quarter of a century right now, for 28 years to be exact. What this event did was it transformed my life. The fact that it was perceived as an attack by members from my own faith community placed an incredible demand upon me as a spokesman for my community, both to help my fellow American citizens both understand not only why it happened and what we can do to prevent this thing from happening.
And
it has transformed my life. It has it has been the cause for which I've devoted the rest of my years now to build the kind of multi-faith relationships and coalitions that can help change the discourse around America vis-a-vis Islam and Muslims, both domestically and internationally.
And you've seen firsthand the kind of divisions this has created. You were involved in the project to develop an Islamic community center just a few blocks from Ground Zero that, is nearly drowned in controversy.
Very much so. And as members of the 9/11 community that whom I spoke with and who made outreach to have pointed out, we need a healing, a national healing in America around 9/11. And this, as important as it is a need, it's a need that we need to together seek to fulfill. And it cannot be done without the voices of the religious community, the faith community, and certainly my faith community as well has to be part of the solution, which is why we're grateful to opportunities like this for us to express our voices and to demonstrate both how this event traumatized our community, how we were among the members who were victimized and by this community, members of our community themselves were among the 9/11 victims, which is why, in our commemoration, the 10th anniversary before last, we held a commemoration in which we honored 10 families, 5 Muslim, 5 non-Muslim, who suffered losses of their families.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. Jane is on the phone calling from Hampton Falls in New Hampshire.
Yes.
Hi, Jane, you're on the air.
on the day of September 11th, I discovered that I was the pastor of one of the victims of the tragedy. And we are clergy, are first responders that often are forgotten or not remembered, not thought of in the whole core of those who are on the scene immediately. And yet it takes an enormous toll on us personally. And the kinds of impact that it has on us, it made me jealous to hear about the agility of the Army. This program has been fascinating this afternoon, and my heart goes out to Michelle. I think there are a lot of those like myself who respond immediately and feel helpless and have that kind of survivor guilt, oddly enough. And suicide among clergy is not a light problem, which is not the point of this discussion, but it is to say that among the first responders and the ways that it changes our lives, we too could really benefit from a greater support system.
And I don't mean to cut you off. I just wanted to, we just have a few seconds left, and I wanted to give Imam Faisal Abdul-Rauf a chance to respond.
Yes, I'd like that.
Well, certainly, those of us who had to minister to those who were victims of this and to those who have survived this tragedy, it has been a tremendous toll upon us. The caregivers need care too, as we've often heard. And we certainly are sustained by our faith in a divine creator, in the creator's mercy and compassion, benevolence and forgiveness. And I was just at the interfaith ceremony a couple of hours ago here on the Upper West Side in Manhattan with B'nai Jeshurun, where we stood with our fellow Christian and Jewish community at St. Paul's and St. Andrew's Church, where we spoke about the importance of forgiveness within our traditions and how forgiveness enabled us to let go of the hate and the anger that kind of keeps eating and eroding our inner sense of stability and centeredness.
Imam Faisal Abdul-Rauf, founder of the American Society for Muslim Advancement. This is NPR News. This is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. New towers will soon stand near what was once called Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan. A memorial there opened for the first time today, fountains flowing into two reflecting pools, the names of victims inscribed in bronze along the edges. From the burning ashes of the Twin Towers, a new reality is emerging, the most obvious physical example of what's changed in the years since September 11th, 2001. That's our focus this hour, 9/11, then and now. Call and tell us what's changed. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And with us is NPR commentator Ted Koppel. And Ted, I wanted to raise some op-ed pieces that we've seen in the past days and to see how we commemorate this event and what we think about 9/11 then and now. There was one printed by Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal, where he noted that December 7th, 1951, came and went with scant ceremony Compare that to the wall-to-wall attention being given to the 10th anniversary of 9/11. All of this is unavoidable and largely appropriate, he wrote, but there is some irony in the fact that our frenzy to memorialize is inversely proportionate to our collective capacity to extract meaning from memory. There's no getting around the sense that the central element of the memorial at Ground Zero is emptiness, a giant vacancy. The pools are too deep even to offer an actual reflection the way Washington's reflecting pool does. Instead, there's a void into which we can weep or scream or just hold still, but it gives nothing back. And he notes that there is a deeper problem, not the fault of the memorial's designers. In 1951, Americans could look back to Pearl Harbor and see its bookends in VE Day and the Japanese surrender on the USS Missouri. In that light, Pearl Harbor may have been a day of infamy, but it was also, well, for all the intelligence failures and military defeat it represented, a day to live down. The war that was begun on September 11th, he notes, has no bookends.
No, I read that. I read that op-ed, and if you had not raised it, I was going to. He made the other observation, as you know, Neil, that President Truman and Vice President Alvin Barkley didn't even attend any public ceremony on that 10th anniversary. We had the knowledge, the satisfaction, the emotional closure by 1951 of knowing that the Japanese had been defeated, the war was over. We were in a post-war period. As you know, the Pentagon, it's not a phrase that is much in favor these days, but the way they have described the war in which we've been engaged over the past 10-plus years, they call it the Long War. I think they stopped using that term publicly because some of the politicians didn't like it. But what they're really saying is that this is a generational war. The fight against terrorism is something that isn't going to end with some singular action or some particular event. It may fizzle out at some point, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. But we're going to keep on fighting that war, and as you have pointed out and others on this program have pointed out, and I think this is terribly important, we don't all have skin in the game. The number of young men and women in the volunteer Army and Air Force and Navy and Marine Corps and Coast Guard, they and their families and their close friends, they are the ones carrying this burden. We have not even paid an additional nickel in a war tax. This war, the war in Iraq and the one in Afghanistan, continue to be fought essentially with borrowed money, with money you could argue that that came through treasury bills that we've sold to the Chinese. Over $1 trillion worth of treasury bills sold to them, and that's just a fraction now of what this war has cost us. Unless and until the American public as a whole begins to share in this burden, I don't think this thing is ever going to be complete.
I want to read another op-ed, this from Paul Wolfowitz, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense in the George W. Bush administration, now a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Those who say it was a mistake to go to Afghanistan and remove the Taliban have an obligation to say what alternative course of action would have produced success. Strategic bombing, the 1998 response on a larger scale, wasn't going to force the Taliban to abandon al-Qaeda, nor would it have enabled us to capture so many key terrorists, and removing the Taliban necessarily confronted us with the challenge of working to create an Afghan government that could stand on its own feet. Similarly, in Iraq, simply continuing the sanctions regime, which was collapsing, would have confronted us sooner or later with the problem of Saddam's WMD ambitions. We might have armed and supported Iraqis to overthrow Saddam instead of a full-scale invasion, but whatever choice we made, I believe it was right to confront him sooner rather than later. 10 years after 9/11, we increasingly hear complaints our response was an overreaction. In fact, by preventing further attacks, we may have prevented a different kind of overreaction, the one that happened 70 years ago. After Pearl Harbor, Japanese-American citizens were put in internment camps, a stain on the record of our democracy. After 9/11, despite some ugly incidents, Americans on the whole behaved well toward their Muslim fellow citizens, and leaders from both political parties went out of their way to emphasize the importance of doing so. That an excerpt from a piece Mr. Wolfowitz wrote for the Weekly Standard.
I think Secretary Wolfowitz is an extraordinarily bright man, but I think he has blinders on when it comes to the effect and the impact of what the war in Iraq has cost this country. He will remember, as I'm sure many of our listeners will remember, that during the 1980s, when Iran and Iraq were at war, and they were at war for most of the 1980s, more than 800,000 young Iranians and Iraqis died. The United States opted to support the selfsame Saddam Hussein. We provided aerial reconnaissance to his military. We provided intelligence to the Iraqis because the perception was that Iran was a greater danger to the national interest of the United States than Iraq was. Ironically, by overthrowing Saddam Hussein, and let me parenthetically say, I understand, he was one of the nastiest pieces of work that this world has ever seen. But by overthrowing him, the ironical consequence of that has been that Iran today, Iran, has more influence in the Persian Gulf than it ever did before we invaded Iraq.
We're talking about then and now, 10 years after 9/11, 800-989-8255, email talk at npr.org. Christopher's on the line calling from St. Joseph, Missouri.
Hi. As I was telling your screener, on 9/11, I worked up in Denver, Colorado. And I was working at a building doing security, and I was at a building that was actually listed as a potential target. And what I saw then was a mindset that 9/11 was a million miles away, that people really just couldn't grasp what had taken place. It didn't personally affect them, and they treated it as though it was an ordinary day. And I think that there's a difference between what happened on 9/11 to our country and what the war has done to this country. I think people see the war and not so much 9/11. I think 9/11 has become a faded event in our history, and it's hard for people that have never been personally involved to really understand what it did to our country. And I think that I think we need to bring that out more so that people understand that it isn't so much about the war itself, but what it cost our country.
Bring it out how, do you think, Christopher?
I'm sorry?
Bring it out how?
Well, I mean, it affected our country in ways of showing
us. No, I heard your point, and I think we got it. You said we need to bring it out more. How do we bring it out?
I think that we need to focus more on the value systems and the morals and the belief systems at that time and to deal with those aspects rather than just focusing on the tragedies that have happened since then in the wars. I think that we need to talk more about 9/11 and less about the war itself. I think we need to focus more about the personal involvement to put it on a personal level instead of just focusing on it as a war, because it becomes blurred. I mean, if the war is something that's so huge that affects so many people, but on a much different level.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Christopher.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we go next to, this is Todd. Todd with us from Rockland in Maine.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. And I sure would like to say to everyone's family victim that was killed in 9/11 that I personally can feel their tragedy. And I also would like to, you know, move on and say from that time of 9/11 to now, I think the war is still going. I think the ability of terrorizing us as a nation has been, you know, underestimated and given a whole new meaning in America, all the way from the way people have to travel now to your interactions and to our own government actions. And I hope that in the end of the day that, you know, we all know that this tragedy has always happened throughout mankind, and it always will happen, and that we should focus our effort forward and know that we stand on the shoulders of giants.
Todd, thanks very much. Let's see if we go next to Bashir. Bashir with us from Orange County in California.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, please.
I'm so glad to with you today, and you have a Mr. Couple, my favorite commentator, actually, from long time. We came here 23 years ago to this country. I came from Muslim family, and as U.S. citizen, you know, I'll tell you the truth, I feel more unity with everybody. We've melted with everybody these days, especially in the anniversary of the September 11th. These days, I believe our mission is really, really in one hand together against the terrorists. It's not about religion. I'm not a religious guy to begin with. But the point is, you know, tell you the truth, through your program, I have announced one really, really effective. As Muslim, I respect myself, I respect others. But let me tell you something. Honestly, if we don't stand up for ourselves in this country to be U.S. citizen, real U.S. citizen, we're not going to go nowhere. That's the bottom line. I don't want to be part of the problem. I want to be part of the solution.
And you think it's excuse me, you think it's improved? You think it's gotten better?
Getting better and better and better. I can't speak on behalf of everybody, but most of my people around me, I'm telling you honestly, it's all about unity in one hand behind, I vote Republican, but behind, and any president and the way of the American go right now, those guys, in my feeling, I read a lot of Arabic newspapers. They're down. They're down. Big time. I feel so comfortable. My son grew up here, for cry out loud. You know, I don't want anybody to harm my son and his friend. And this is our country. We feel so good and so powerful because we are one hand. And my special announcement to you today, finally, it's all about, like, when I'm talking about Mr. Sheikh Mohammed, we will try him at New York. I am more proud to put my hand on the sweatshirt when we execute him. I am more proud to put my single hand in this sweatshirt beside Jewish, Christian, and all American, because we're all American. We have to end this terrorism. And I'm telling you, they are now.
Bashir?
That's the reason I love President Bush. He built a big wall against these guys. And the following president will continue. And God bless America.
Thank you very much for the call, Bashir. Appreciate it.
Got it.
Ted Koppel, interesting. He spoke about unity. And then and now, many people would say the sense of unity, which may have been, tremendous in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the Congress coming out and singing together on the steps of the Capitol in the immediate aftermath of the event, that aspect of American society has gone. It was a fragile moment, and it vanished very quickly.
I believe the candle flickered a little bit today, Neil. I feel like a bit of a traitor on NPR saying I was watching television this morning, but I was. I must tell you, I thought the brevity and the humility of both President Bush and President Obama in just making reading very, very brief segments, the somberness of the occasion, the nonpartisanship of the occasion, the tragedy of seeing the faces of those who were left behind and who lost fathers and sons and brothers and sisters and wives. It was as though we were, for a brief moment, able to recapture that sense of being one people, as we did and as we were 10 years ago today. Tragically, we know that that's not going to last, but we need to keep reminding ourselves that we are at our best when we all work together. We are at our best when we seek common ground. And you're right in what was implicit in your question to me. We haven't seen a whole lot of that in the last few years.
And we began talking about the lack of a bookend. There is not likely to be a bookend beyond the death of Osama bin Laden. The United States troops are scheduled to leave Iraq at the end of this year. It looks like some may stay. Who knows how long it'll be in Afghanistan? What do you think the celebration of the anniversary of 9/11 will be like 10 years from now?
I don't know, Neil, except that I rather fear. Look, the nature of terrorism, Lenin said the intent of terrorism, the purpose of terrorism is to terrorize. And the fact of the matter is that it is and has been for many, many generations the tool of the weak against the strong. And much of what has happened in this country over the past 10 years, I think, must have exceeded the wildest expectations of Osama bin Laden. Simply the money that we have expended in fighting two wars and in cranking up an enormous top secret. There's a wonderful book by Dana Priest that just came out.
And Bill Arkin,
called
yes.
Top Secret. Yes, Top Secret America. And she points out that there are now, in the wake of 9/11, 850,000 people in this country who have top secret clearance. The money that has been spent is so extraordinary, amounts to so many hundreds of billions, indeed trillions of dollars, that what has happened over these past 10 years has to have had an impact on our economy, which now is in the dumps. That's not unrelated. And much of that we have done to ourselves in the sense that I believe we have overreacted. It was not necessary that quite as much be done as has been done, nor that we keep fighting two wars.
Ted Koppel, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you, Neil.
NPR commentator Ted Koppel joined us from his home in Maryland, and we'd like to thank all of you for your calls and emails today. But before we leave you, perhaps after a day where everybody's been talking, we can take just a moment for silence, to reflect, and to remember. You've been listening to live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attack from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.